Back to Megillas Rus. We left off last week on page 1269, up to verse 14. Verse 14 leaves us with a very important fact. And this is the point when the two girls split. Orpah goes back to the land of Moab to rejoin her religion, her pagan religion, her Moabite family. And Rus clings to Naomi, and she decides to become a Jew. So let's read verse 14. They raised up their voice and wept again. So they cried. They're awkward. It's a very emotional moment, all these women together. Naomi had tried to persuade them to go back home to Moab. The girls originally stuck with Naomi. At this point, Naomi said, I have no more children to offer you. I'm an older woman. If I were to have a child tonight, you still have to wait for him to be marriageable age. Why are you coming with me? So they started crying again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So this is the famous line, Rus davka ba. Rus remained clinging to her mother-in-law, whereas Orpah turned back. So that's verse 14. I want to discuss a little bit about the difference of Orpah and Rus. Now last week we stressed that the exposure of these two girls to Judaism and to Torah came through Naomi. And Naomi is somebody who was such a refined person with such stellar midos, such a stellar character, that they were drawn to God and Torah through Naomi. They both had the same exposure, but yet there's still a difference. Orpah turns back, and Rus sticks with Naomi. So where do we find the difference between Orpah and Rus? They're different people. Obviously, different people have different emotions, different thought processes, but there's a way that is stressed by their names, which actually shows their difference.
Orif.
Turn the back. Orif.
Right.
Ayin Reish Peh is the neck.
Okay, so you already
stiff-necked
people, right? Right. So the name Orpah itself, as they're saying, the letters it's composed of, Ayin Resh Pei Hey, are the letters Orif, which again means the back of the neck, And the concept of Orif used in the Torah usually means us being stubborn. Yeah. The Jews are called in the desert Am Kashay Orif. You're stubborn. You're a stiff-necked, stubborn nation. Which means, we'll talk about what it means to be stubborn in a minute. But Orpah, because she, her personality, you know, a name very much indicates personality, was a stubborn personality. She was somebody who was stiff-necked in that sense. So even though there was a message that was being transmitted to her from her mother-in-law, she could have taken in that message and become as great as Rus, because of her personality, because of that trait of being stubborn, she didn't take it in. It's the same exact letter as the word paro. It's the same way Ayin Resh Peh Hey, you can rearrange them to say paro. Mm-hmm. Because Paro, he experienced 10 plagues. Mm-hmm. And Paro, seeing God's miracles, didn't want to change. Even though there was a very clear message sent to Paro, he didn't change because of that. So Orpah and Paro are the same letters in the alphabet. The Jews are referred to several times in Torah as Am Kashay Orif, a stiff-necked nation. The concept of Kashay Orif, I mean, the translation is a stiff neck. You know, you have a very stiff neck. The idea is, this is a comment of the Sforno. The Sforno says that having a stiff neck means that, let's say you're walking off a cliff. Everyone's saying, turn right, turn right, you're about to walk off a cliff. You say, I'm not listening, I'm going straight, no one's going to stop me, I do what I want, and I'm not going to listen to anybody else, I'm not going to turn my neck and turn myself around. That's how he describes being stiff-necked, which means stubborn, but stubborn to the point that even people who are there trying to help you, you disregard. That's the idea of being stubborn. I go on my path, I do it my way, you're not going to change me, I don't care what you say. So Orpah, that was her personality. She was not receptive to the message in the same way that Rus was. Rus was receptive to Naomi. Additionally, you know, the Malbim writes that Orpah was in it for her own personal benefit. So initially she went along with Naomi. When Naomi convinced them, I have nothing to offer you, I'm a poor lady, I have no more children, I have nothing to give you in Israel. So he said, okay, no, you're right. I have nothing to gain from coming along with you. I'm turning around. But Rus was in it not for her own personal benefit. She was in it to do good. And she recognized truth. And because she recognized the truth, and she was able to receive the message of Naomi, she kept on going.
Does Rut have a meaning, the name
Rut? There's several meanings which are talked about for her name. Number one, this is kind of like, this is a sort of a remez, a hint. But the gematria of Rus is 606. Because when she was not Jewish, she had 7 mitzvos. When she became Jewish, she added on 606 more. It makes 613.
Oh, right?
That's one thing which is said.
Yeah.
It also can be rearranged to spell the word tur, a turtle dove. The two birds that we offered as sacrifices in the Beis Hamikdash were a Yonah and a Tor, a dove and a turtle dove. Yeah. And both these birds, they're known to be birds which are very, very, you know, calm, docile, peaceful.
Loyal to the husband.
Right, loyal, exactly. They're the monogamous birds. So Rus also had that trait of being a Tor, that she was devoted, she was peaceful, similar to the turtle dove. And the Gemara actually relates the word Rus to the word Rava, like to provide drink, to make somebody saturated, and says that Rus is somebody destined to have a child who will saturate God with praises, King David, David HaMelech. So that's another reference in the word Rus itself, Rava, to saturate. But this concept also, this concept of mentioning of Orpah, of being stubborn, it's an interesting concept, because we find really contradictory descriptions of it throughout the writings of the sages. On the one hand, the Mishnah tells us in Pirkei Avos, as panam lo gehenim, if you're stubborn, you go straight to gehenim. That's it, straight down. That's where you're going, someone who's stubborn. On the other hand, it says, hevi az kanamer, you should be stubborn, bold, they've translated as, or stubborn like a leopard. Right? I'm not sure what a leopard does that's so stubborn, but it says be stubborn like a leopard. So on the one hand, there's a concept that being stubborn, being she'orif, is a terrible, terrible mita to have. It's something which will lead a person to the wrong path. On the other hand, that we are directed that we should develop some sense of being stubborn or being bold. What's the difference? I think the difference is very simple. When it says heavy az kanamer, that you should be bold as a leopard, so the Mishnah continues, lasos eson avicha shebas shemayim, to do the will of your Father in heaven. Meaning, if we're stubborn, that we're doing the wrong things, we're walking off that cliff, we say, no one tells me what to do. I don't listen to anybody around. Well, obviously, that person is hopeless. Because you can sit there and explain to them, you know, what you're doing is not right, it's not appropriate, it's immoral, it's going to lead you in the wrong path. And they're going to say, I don't care what you have to say. So the only place they're going to end up going is Gehenna. You know, they're going straight to the wrong place. But, and on the other hand, unless someone's doing the right thing, if somebody is dedicated to keeping mitzvos, and they live in a society where the culture around says, why are you doing that? No, you're strange, you're different. Come join us, do what we tell you to do. Don't stick to your ways. So we have to be stubborn. No, Jews have to be stubborn. If Jews weren't stubborn, we'd be gone long ago. The Gemara actually says that Jews are called the Azin Shebeumos, or the most stubborn of all nations. Which has its positives and negatives.
How did you say it in Hebrew?
Azin Shebeumot.
Azin with azin.
Oh, like an Azuz Panim.
Like Azut, yeah. Like Azut Panim. Right? We are the most stubborn of all nations. And God chose us that way, because if not, then we wouldn't have withstood all of the pressure put upon us the past 3,000 years. Mm-hmm. Only because we have that trait can we survive. On the other hand, it leads us into trouble, such as Am Kishe Oref. In the desert, God said, you're a stubborn nation, what am I going to do with you? You won't accept upon yourself my authority. So we need that trait, but yet that trait makes it difficult for us sometimes to accept authority and to do what's right. So it's a balance we have to strike. So that's what Orpah. Orpah was somebody who had this trait in a negative way. So even though she was given a clear message of truth, of greatness, she did not receive the message. So it says at this point that Anami kissed Orpah, and Orpah seems to have gone her way. But yeah, it's Rus clung, or it's cling or clung, I don't know the word, clung. What's the right word?
Clung.
Rus clung to her mother-in-law. A Hasidic concept. You know, this is a concept, but it's not necessarily the simple meaning, but a much more symbolic concept. Is a interesting Dekus. And when it says that, initially we find back in Pasuk Tes, verse 9, the Nami kissed both of them. She kissed Orpah and she kissed Rus. In verse 14, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law back and left. So some Hasidic, great Hasidic thought is the following, that when Naomi first kissed the two girls, Naomi was a very righteous woman. And kissing is a type of connection. She was trying to show a bond with them and somehow, you know, transmit some of her greatness into these girls and see what happens. You know, can you handle this type of holiness or not? So she kissed Naomi and Rus. So Rus got the kiss and said, excuse me, yeah, thank you. Orpah and Rus, right. So Rus got the kiss and she said, this is great. This is me. This fits who I am. And she stuck with it. Orpah, when she got this kiss, felt it didn't fit with her personality, didn't fit with her lifestyle, and she gave it back. Over here it says she kissed her mother-in-law, meaning she returned that holiness, she returned that connection before she went back to Moab. So whatever she had gained from being around this righteous woman, she had returned at this point before she went back to her people. The sages do relate that when she went back, she did all sorts of terrible sins. I mean, she went back to a life of not just like she was okay, she went back to a very immoral, inappropriate lifestyle after this. So she was on the verge of becoming a great Jewish woman, and because of this moment, she went back, and then negative things happened to her. But we see on another level that Orpah certainly thought she was listening initially, but really Rus was the one who got the message. I mean, Orpah listened to her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law said, "Don't come with me. You have nothing to gain from coming along. I have nothing to offer you." So Orpah said, "Okay, you're right," and she went back. We think Rus was the one who was going against her mother-in-law's wishes, because she said, "No, I'm coming with you. You told me to go away. I'm following you no matter what." But the truth is that there was a very, very subtle message that Naomi was giving over to these two girls. Even though she was trying to persuade them to go back, the way she spoke to them, she kept saying to them, "Benosai, my dear daughters." Mm-hmm. And she was showing her love and care in her speech. Meaning she's trying to test the waters. You know, if these girls understand me, they understand that I care for them and love them, and they'll stick with me. But I want them to recognize that coming along to be a Jew is a big decision, and if they can't handle it, they should turn back. So who really heard Naomi's message? Rus heard Naomi's message, because she heard Naomi's love and care in her tone of voice. She heard that Naomi was really trying to reach out to them as her daughters. Orpah only heard the superficial message. She heard the words, but she didn't hear the care and the love in the words, so she turned back. And the lesson for us, I think, is that we have to learn how to listen sometimes. And sometimes someone will tell us X, and deep down they're trying to convey Y, but they're not saying it explicitly to us. You know, it's one of the issues of communication people have with each other, certainly in marriages and amongst friends. You know, there's something which is said, and there's a subtle message within it. And we only hear the superficial words, but we miss out on the actual content of the subtle message that's within. So Naomi, on the superficial level, is saying, "You go back, I have nothing to offer you." Deep down, she was saying, "I love you so much. I care for you and my daughters. I wish you would stay with me." So Rus heard that deeper message, and Orpah missed it. So let's keep going into verse 15. So she said, "Look, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and to her God. Go follow your sister-in-law." So she's still pushing her away. "Look, Orpah went back. What about you?" 16. But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you, to turn back and not follow you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people are my people, and your God is my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. Thus may Hashem do to me and more, if anything but death separates me from you." And this is Rus's, you know, most powerful speech in some ways. "No matter what, I am with you. I want to be part of your people. I want to be your daughter-in-law. I want to stick with you through thick and thin." That's what she tells her. The rabbis see here an interesting conversation. The rabbis see in this that Rus here is responding to something. When she says, "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge." There was a conversation being had between Naomi and Rus. Naomi tells her, "Well, if you're Jewish, you have to go here." I'll say what the "here" is in a minute. And then Rus says, "Well, where you go, I'll go. If you're Jewish, you must lodge in this way." She says, "Where you lodge, I lodge. If you're Jewish, you might die in this manner. Where you die, I die." And it's a conversation back and forth.
About Giyur, no?
About Giyur. So that when it comes to converting people to Judaism, so we know that we first try to dissuade them from coming along. Yeah, and even when they keep saying, "No, I want to be Jewish," we then start explaining to them some of the rules and some of the challenges of being Jewish, because they have to be fully committed, you know, heart and soul, to become Jewish. So Naomi here is a source for this concept, and she is trying to describe to Rus, "Well, if you want to be Jewish and follow me to Eretz Yisrael, this is what's going to happen to you. And are you ready for these challenges?" So just to discuss a little bit of what Naomi is warning Rus about, we see, let me scoot my notes over here, we see that whatever it was, Rus says, "Nothing will stop me. I am joining you. I'm joining the Jewish people." And now she's going to be tested by Naomi to see, well, are you really committed or not? So one thing she says is, "Asher telchi eilech," where you go, I will go. So one thing Rashi describes, we don't have the Rashi quoted here, but Rashi describes that she warns her about the idea of Tchum Shabbos. Now, on Shabbos, you're not allowed to travel past 2,000 amos out of your city, about, you know, 4,000 feet or so outside the city limits, which isn't all that relevant in big cities like ours. But if you're in smaller places, you know, when I'm off at camp in the summer, for instance, or when you're in smaller places where the city ends, you know, pretty close by, then there actually is an issue of traveling 2,000 amos, about 4,000 feet beyond that limit. So she warns her about traveling on Shabbos. So she says, well, you go, I'll go. If that's my rules, I'll follow those rules. The Midrash actually says another idea over here. The Midrash says that she tells her, my daughter. Now, Jewish girls should not go, and the example is given, are to theaters and circuses of the pagans. And she says, well, you go, I will go. So if those who are aware of what happened in the Roman theaters 2,000 years ago or the like, it was not pleasant, it was not appropriate, there was a lot of things happening which were very, very against Torah values, you know, such as, you know, gladiators and killing animals, all sorts of crazy things happening, and most of these shows were inappropriate for a Jewish girl to watch.
That's several hundred.
That's
years.
Real. I'm just using that as an example. I don't know what happened in Moabite times, so that's why I'm using that as an example. You're right. I have no history in Moabite theaters, so I think it's prehistory. But she warns her: you have to go to see appropriate things, appropriate places as a Jewish girl. If you want to remain a Moabite, you can go watch whatever you want. But if not, if you become Jewish, you have to follow in our ways, stick to our culture, and only go to things which are appropriate to see. So why is this the first thing that Naomi wants to tell Ruth? Of all the things she could have mentioned, it's the very first thing told to her. Mm-hmm. And there's a very profound concept over here, which is that what she's warning her is that, you know, there's a culture outside, and that culture educates. I mean, we know very well in modern days, a lot of education of kids comes from TV and movies and books they read and things very close to society, for better or for worse. I'm not saying all bad or all good, but they're educated through culture around. We all are. Because as we immerse ourselves in the surrounding culture, the ideas seep in, both directly and indirectly. So we have to recognize as Jews that we have to be sure that we're only educated in terms of our philosophy and our values, not through society around, but through the Torah. And if you want to be Jewish, the very first step is to recognize you need to make sure you embrace our system of values, our system of morality, our system of ethics, our system of philosophy. And you can't be Jewish if you're going to stick to what society teaches you. Like we said, we have to be stubborn because society sometimes teaches us things which are anti our beliefs, and we have to be stubborn and say, no, I'm not accepting that philosophy or that value. I have my own values I stick to. But the more we expose ourselves to those values in society, so the more they seep into us, and they may or may not be in line with Torah values. So this is an issue that we have to grapple with constantly in our time and in their time. This is a historical issue. It's always been an issue amongst the Jews. I think it's probably even worse in our times because we have so much access to the ideas which are out there. So some things are positive and some things are negative, but it's a warning to Rus to tell her, you know, if you become Jewish, recognize you have to drop that attitude, that system around you, and realize that your values must be formed through Jewish values, and that which is taught by the culture around is something which you have to take in very, very carefully. Because they meant, yeah.
So they didn't convert before they married?
No. She's only converted. No, they intermarried. She's only converting at this point. That's one of the reasons they were punished by God. They died, both Orpah and Ruth's husbands. So we have to be sure that society, and this is something we have to always think about. We can't let society dictate our values. We have to, when we hear something in society, we have to think back and say, what would the Torah say about this issue? And that's our job. You know, for us, the main point is not what society says, it's what the Torah says. The Torah says it's right, it's right. The Torah says it's wrong, it's wrong. But just because I saw it on TV, read about it in the paper, or heard about it, you know, in some sort of lecture I was listening to, that doesn't make it right. That doesn't make it right. We have to make sure the Torah says it's right. So the very first warning she gets is that if you become Jewish, recognize you can't be going to these places of the culture around that are going to give you the wrong ideas of philosophy and values. It's going to corrupt the way that you think. You're not going to be able to live as a Jew in that way. That's one thing said. Then it says, and another example of what she told her. So she says to her, Basher Talini Alin, where you lodge, I will lodge. So what does that refer to? So Rashi points out that she informed her about the rules of Yichud, of seclusion of men and women. And we have halachas about men and women being secluded together that aren't married. You know, what are the rules? How many? Relatives? Not relatives? There's a big discussion, a lot of details about Yichud, about being secluded with the opposite gender. And she warns her, you know, right now when you're not Jewish, you can seclude yourself wherever you want. It's okay. There's no rules of Yichud if you're not Jewish. If you become Jewish, you have to follow the rules of Yichud. Now again, we wouldn't put this at the very top of the list. You know, we would think maybe like Shabbos, keeping kosher, like maybe Yom Kippur. Like there's a lot of things we might put on top of the laws of Yichud. But she warns her about the laws of Yichud. And I think that the message being given to her is that when you're a Jew, we have very high standards of morality. And you know, as a non-Jew, non-Jews also, the mitzvah, the Noahide laws do include rules about illicit relationships. That's there. But they don't have all of these different guidelines and fences which are established to keep the people, to keep the genders separate, to avoid any issues. When you become a Jew, we have to realize that we have very high moral standards, which might seem to be extreme in society, but yet we try to live on a level of sanctity which goes beyond society. So this is something that you have to be able to recognize to become Jewish. Now, I haven't verified this, but someone told me that the vice president also very careful about yichud. Anyone hear this?
Yeah,
that he won't close the door with women in his office.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Oh, fantastic.
President, yeah. Yeah, Vice President Pence. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Where did he get his moral attitude?
I mean, he's a very religious person in his own right. And I think he wants to...
No. He's very religious.
He is a religious person. Yeah. Yeah, he's a religious person.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. But I think that's... No. And also, I'm sure in this day and age, you don't be accused of anything either. But no, he tries to...
I think that's kind of...
But you don't find that amongst politicians. I'm saying that they don't... You know, it was interesting, but I've heard Vice President Pence does not close the door of his office with a woman inside.
That's, you know. That's so nice. What did you
read? Someone told me this, but people seem to be aware. It was not, you know.
I'm joking.
I mean, a friend of mine mentioned this to me, but it seems to be it's a known fact. Have you heard this before?
Yeah, I've heard
okay.
this.
Yeah.
Time.
Okay. So, anyways, we can't speak for the president, but the vice president we can speak for. You know? So, the president might be a different story. The message given to her is that if you want to be Jewish, recognize we have very high moral standards. So number one, so right now she's talking to her more not about specific halachas and rules and mitzvos, but about general, broader topics. You have to make sure that if you're Jewish, your values come through Torah. If you're Jewish, you have to develop very high moral standards. Then she says to her, Ameich Ami, now your nation is my nation. Which on that, Naomi was warning her, you know, if you're Jewish, we have a lot of mitzvos that distinguish you from the Gentiles. You know, you have to eat kosher, and you can't drink their wine, you have to have Shabbos, and you can't attend everything that they invite you to because there might be problems in their parties with halachas, and all sorts of things that will keep you separate from the non-Jews. You might look a little different, you have to dress in a certain way sometimes. There's a lot of things that might distinguish you. And she says, your nation is my nation. Meaning, I'm willing to take that leap and become different and be distinguished as a Jew, even though society around may look at me in a... different in a negative way. And again, this is another challenge for people that it's not easy to feel different and look different. Now, we as Jews, especially, you know, when we live in a non-Jewish society, so at times we're forced to say, you know, I'm Jewish and I can't do that. Or I'm Jewish and this is not something which I want to participate in. I can't do it, it's Pesach. I can't eat that, it's not kosher. I can't come, it's Shabbos. And we have those issues that come up to us all the time. And it's uncomfortable. It can be very uncomfortable to have to tell a coworker, an acquaintance, even a family member who's not observant, I can't be involved in this event because, you know, it doesn't conform to my standards of halacha. It happens to us, you know, in many different settings, in many different ways. And that's also a challenge, especially of a ger, of a convert, but to any Jew, is that you're going to have to be a little bit different than those around you. For a convert especially, I mean, a convert is cutting herself off from her nation, from her family, from her friends, from the past. And if Rus ever decides to go back and visit, you know, her siblings, she's going to be the outsider. She'll be ostracized. I don't know if she did or she didn't. You know, but people experience that. People who are converts do experience that, and often they're able to have a very nice relationship. Often it's a very difficult relationship. Same thing with Balei Tshuva. Somebody who moves towards observance and has a non-observant family, they have issues sometimes because the family looks at them as you're the odd one. You're doing these strange things that we don't understand. And it's an uncomfortable feeling. But that's the warning that she gives her. You have to understand that you will stand out if you become a Jewish. And you'll be distant from your previous lifestyle. And maybe from your friends and from your family. But that's what it takes. You want to be Jewish, you have to accept to be part of our nation. Act like our nation, look like our nation, and be distinguished. On the other hand, you mentioned the Haggadah on Pesach a few weeks ago. Then we went down to Mitzrayim. It says the Jews are Metsuyanim Sham. They were distinguished there. Now, even though the Jews had very little merit when they were in Egypt, the merit they did have was that they remained distinguished. The sages point out that they kept their language, they kept their dress, they kept their names, because even though they may have been drawn into idolatry, and they may have done things which are not conforming to Jewish standards, they at least were proud to remain distinguished Jews. And that itself was a great advantage which they had in Mitzrayim, which is one of the reasons that God decided to come in and pull us out. That's what the sages teach us. So she warns her, if you want to be Jewish, you have to recognize you will be distinguished, you look different, and you have to accept that. So Rosh says, okay, your nation is my nation. Here's another one which I always find to be very powerful. This other one I've mentioned before, I think, at some point in this class, but I'll mention it again. It's, she says, Basher tamusi amus, where you die, I will die. Mm-hmm. So what's that response to? So the Naomi had told her, you know, if you become Jewish, we do have a concept of capital punishment. And if you perform a sin, you know, purposely, with the proper testimony, witnesses, and warning, you can be executed by a Beis Din. When you are a Moabite, so then, you know, there also is a capital punishment for Noahides, but it's not, there aren't as many instances as there are for Jews. And, you know, last week you could have done, you know, this action and been totally fine, and next week, if you're Jewish, you could be executed by a Beis Din for doing it. Do you want to take that risk? Now, hopefully, Rus is not planning to purposely violate the Torah at this point, but even so, it is something to think about, because, you know, people do sometimes have changes of thought, or they have moods, and might do something which is wrong, and a Beis Din could execute you. What do you say about that? And she also tells her, and when Beis Din executes somebody, there's a special cemetery for those who are killed by Beis Din, and you'll be separated out in shame in the cemetery. And she says, well, where you die, I'll die, and I'll be buried there too. I'm willing to take that risk, even if I become Jewish, and next week I decide to do a sin which will warrant execution, and I die as a Jew, it was all worth it. That's what she says. And I just find that to be a very powerful statement, because that statement is saying that being a Jew is such a special privilege, that even if you become a Jew and have to be executed by a Beis Din, it is still all worth it. Because she could have lived a very happy life as a Moabite, and she would have been fine, but it's still worth it to her to become Jewish, even if it means capital punishment and execution. That's what it means to be Jewish. The privilege of being a Jew, the greatness of being a Jew, is really emphasized through this. Now, we don't always think about it in this way. You know, something doesn't cross our minds. We don't realize what it means to be Jewish, the privilege we have, the power we have in terms of influencing the world, the reward we get from God for doing what's right. It goes far beyond that which any Gentile could ever achieve. And it's not, we're not saying it out of arrogance, we're saying it as a fact. God said, you're my chosen people, I'm giving you responsibilities, and I'm giving you a lot of privileges as well. Like you tell a kid, you're getting older now, so I'll give you a lot more privileges, but you have your responsibilities as well. It goes together. So we have a lot of responsibility, we have a lot of privilege. And Rose says, you know, it's worth it for me to be Jewish, even if it ends up that I have to be executed. It was still well worth it.
Is this where we learn that you should dissuade somebody from becoming Jewish?
Yes, exactly here. Right? That's what she's doing.
But you don't see Naomi's side of it. That's no, you only see...
Right, we see the response of Rose. Right, but she's responding to something.
Idea.
Right.
Yeah.
There's an implicit conversation happening, which mm-hmm. doesn't record here in the Megillah, but it's actually mm-hmm. the conversation occurring. There's a comment made, it's really from the Gemara, I'm quoting from the Rambam, it's really from the Gemara, and the comment is about some of the things we tell people who are on their way to conversion. So one of the things we tell them, which I always find very powerful, the Rambam, I'm quoting from the Rambam now, the Rambam says, what do we tell somebody who wants to convert? So he says, we tell them, why'd you come to convert? Don't you know that the Jews in this time, in the time of exile, we are downtrodden, we are oppressed, we are, you know, a despicable nation, and, you know, we are thrown around from country to country, and we're suffering. Don't you know that? That's what you tell the person. Now, thank God right now, we feel here in America pretty comfortable, but classically, the Jew in exile has had to undergo very terrible conditions, you know, over and over and over again. But why would you want to join our nation and have to be subject to pogroms and to a Holocaust and to Arab terrorists coming to attack? Why would you want to get involved in that? You could live a very peaceful life in Moab. Well, why do you want to join us? So that's what we tell the convert. And the response is supposed to be, Ani yodea ve'ini kedai. I'm well aware of it, and I'm still unworthy of being Jewish. Meaning, it would be such a privilege to be Jewish despite it all. And that's what Rus is saying, that despite the fact that being Jewish may make me be accountable for my actions, and will subject me to all the anti-Semitism and all the persecution we've gone through over the past 2,000 years, despite it all, it's well worth it. That's what Rus responds. It's a very important thought for us to always have in mind, because we as Jews have to have the same attitudes as the convert would have, whether we're converted or not. If we're Jewish right now, that means that we have to maintain that attitude. So whether you're born Jewish or not born Jewish, the point is that you have to have that same devotion and that same appreciation of being Jewish as a convert's supposed to have. At this point, let's read the next verse, 16. But Ruth said, we already 16, we are up to
18,
yeah, thank you. When she saw she was determined to go with her, she stopped arguing with her. So when she saw the determination, she said, okay, I'll take you. That's it. And from here, we actually learn an important halacha. You know, when we are trying to dissuade a person from converting, once we see they're devoted, we stop bothering them. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you grill them until you're sure of their sincerity. Once you see the sincerity, at that point, you say, okay, you know, you accept them in and you warmly teach them how to become a Jew. So Naomi, so she's pretty serious, right? She's willing to respond to all my questions. She said the right answers. She's a serious convert. At this point, we'll stop and we'll take you back to Israel. So that's verse 18. Let's look at 19. And the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem, to Beis Lechem. And it came to pass, when they arrived in Beis Lechem, the entire city was tumultuous over them. And the woman said, could this be Naomi? So this is also another very important verse. Every verse has so much meaning packed into it. So the two of them together, it says, Vatelachna shtehem. The two of them went together. So the sages tell us that by saying they went together means we've now equated Rus to Naomi. I mean, until now, Naomi was this righteous Jewish woman from a very esteemed and distinguished family. Rus was this pagan from Moab. And now that Rus has decided to become Jewish in such a sincere and devoted way, at this point they're equals.
It's like in the
Akedah, right. It's the same concept, that the Shnehem Yachdav. So Rashi says it shows the Chavivus, how dear, how precious a convert is to God. Because now a convert is on the same level as this significantly righteous and special woman, Naomi. I'm going to read to you a very powerful comment made. You know, every single day when we daven, the Shemar Esrei, three times a day, we actually daven for converts. Right? We say, Val Geri Hatzedek Ve'alinu. We daven, may God show his kindness to the righteous converts and upon us. So they get singled out in davening three times a day, that God should show his kindness to them. So the Rav Yonah...
First.
What?
They mentioned.
And mentioned first, even, right. Right, thank you. So Rav Yonah Sin Eibeshitz, who was a very great Jewish thinker and genius, he has a commentary on the Siddur, on Shemar Esrei. And he writes about this bracha. And he says that, you know, we especially daven for the benefit of converts. And then he says, the yasim alibo, person should focus on, this when they make this bracha, to love the convert as love themselves, and to do the mitzvah of loving the convert. And then he says, and certainly, even the more so nowadays, that we as Jews are lowly, and we are persecuted and downtrodden, and we have very little life left to us. Now he's writing, and I think the... early 1800s, late 1700s in Europe, where Jews were really oppressed, going through very difficult times. Urashoyim betachlus haromimus, and the wicked, they're on top of the world. And this convert, despite it all, recognized the truth. So this person, who again could have lived a very comfortable lifestyle as a Gentile, decided that despite the fact that this nation is going through so much suffering, I see that they are ones who possess the truth, and I'm going to join them. Hareza mamish maisei efshari. He says this is nearly an impossible feat. Mm-hmm. What the convert does is miraculous, because in this dark, dark world, they recognize God. So he says it's our obligation to love the convert, and we should kiss his footsteps. What he says that's the feelings we should have, okay. And the more we love a convert, shows our love for God and for his Torah, because when you love a convert, that's because you love God, so therefore you love people who have become devoted to God.
Well, Gemara says a similar sort of thing, that how precious is the convert because he's done this.
Right.
And therefore how he works together with the Jew, with Mafrek in front.
Right, very good. Right, exactly.
I think Abba, you gave us a few months ago about...
We spoke about this mitzvah, yes, correct,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
I quoted this then also. Right, correct.
He didn't appreciate it.
Could you say Abram was the first Geir?
He's considered the father. He is called the father of all Gerim.
Oh,
he's
really?
Called. Yeah.
Oh, that's
cool. Why when you call convert the Torah, you call them Ben Avraham Avinu, right? Mm-hmm. And Ben Sari Imenu, because Avraham and Sarah were the parents of all converts.
Yeah.
That's how they're viewed.
So
that's how we describe this bracha. So we daven on behalf of converts three times a day, and that's because our love for the convert shows our love of God. And we look at this person and say, this person did something that was incredible, astonishing. That they're able to pick themselves up out of regular everyday life in this world and recognize the truth despite all the difficulties that come with being Jewish and despite all the wickedness out there in the world. So that's what he describes. So at this point we describe that Nami and Rus are on a similar level because she has now devoted herself to convert. Now the verse tells us that they went to the city of Bethlehem, Beis Lechem, and when they came to the city, so everybody saw them coming in. So there's a comment made as to what was happening. Like, why were they all together? Like, it sounds like everyone was outside doing something together, and they saw these two ladies walk in, and they were astonished by them. Why were they all outside together? So the sages tell us that everyone had gathered together that day for the funeral of Boaz's wife. Now, Boaz is going to be the hero of our story, who's going to take Rus in and marry her. That day, when Rus had returned from Moab for the very first time, that was the day that Boaz's wife had died, and they were all busy at the funeral of Boaz's wife. So I find this to be a tremendous act of hashkacha, divine providence. Because God's setting up a situation. Boaz is already at this point a seasoned, aged sage. He's the leader of the Jews. He's one of the judges. And he already had many, many children at this point. And he was, I think, in his 90s or something. He was an older man at this point. And his wife passed away. But the same day his wife passed away, Rus came on the scene. Because God was setting it up that Boaz is going to be the one who's going to marry Rus and then bring forth the lineage of King David. That's how God was setting it up. It's very similar to the concept that before Haman came on the scene, Esther was already in the palace. Now God sets things up so that when he has a plan, he puts things in place for the plan to occur, and you actually see that connection. Food before the Makkah, right. We'll talk about it more later on in the Megillah, but the Chasam Sofer has a calculation that the day that Rus and Boaz married was the 17th of Tammuz. So that 17th of Tammuz was the day where we worshiped the golden calf, and Moshe broke the tablets. That was the day where Moshe came down from Har Sinai, and that should have been the greatest day in Jewish calendar. That was the day where we were supposed to complete the giving of the Torah, and it became a tragic day because we had sinned and worshiped the golden calf, and Moshe broke the tablets on that day. So on that very same day, that same date, God sets up the birth of Mashiach, because Mashiach will stem from the relationship of Rus and Boaz. So again, you see that there's the providence that this day, which is a day of such tragedy, is the day that brings forth such salvation. One other fact that I always find interesting, which relates, is that we know in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. We all know that poem. And we also know, unfortunately, that year was expulsion of Jews from Spain. Right? In the same exact year. Now, we know that in the golden age of Spain, the main location of Jewish life that was thriving was in Spain. And on that same exact year, the same exact month, I believe, Columbus set out and discovered America. Because God was setting it up that right now, Spain's coming to an end. The Jews will spend several centuries, thriving in Europe, but they need a place to go after that. And God was laying the groundwork that after Europe, unfortunately, collapses, you'll have a place to go in America. And it was all being set up in that same exact year. Again, I've read, I don't have a source for this, but I've read that they actually delayed Columbus's voyage because the Jews were all taking up the ports, leaving at that time because they're being expelled from the country. So Columbus's voyage and the Jews' expulsion were really tied hand in hand together. But it's all this, the divine providence works that God fits all pieces together. So the very fact that Rus arrived on the day of Boaz's wife's funeral, that's a very, very powerful message. So they came into the city, and just another minute, I don't want to go too late, but another minute, let's finish this verse. They came into the city, and it says everybody was tumultuous over them. The people were astonished by both these ladies. And commentaries point out, they were astonished for different reasons. They were astonished by Rus, because they saw a girl who came from Moabite royalty had given everything up to become Jewish. That itself was miraculous. She decided to join our nation, despite all she had back in Moab. The opportunities that were there for her, she dropped it all to join our nation. So that was astonishing. But also, what was astonishing in the other way was to see Nami. Yeah. Nami left over 10 years, like 10, I think 10 years or so back, as a wealthy woman with a family. She was even pregnant, the sages tell us, commentaries say at the time, and she came back with nothing. No husband, no children, no money, in rags, with nothing. And people said, could this be Nami? How is this possible? They said it as a question, a rhetorical question, because they were astonished by her tragic story. Very similar to the story of Eov, of Job. Everything was lost. And as she came back, they couldn't believe. They looked at her with pity and shame. How could a person who was so great, at such stature, have fallen so low? We know that when we mourn on Tisha B'Av, we read the book of Eicha. The term Eicha itself, how could it be? That's how we begin the story. How could it be that Jerusalem has fallen? We say it as a question because it's so astonishing to us. Something that's so we can't even imagine. How could it be this great city has fallen? How could it be this great woman has sunk to such lows? People just couldn't believe it. So as they returned, people were astonished by seeing this Moabite girl who had come to join the nation. But they're also astonished by the tragic story of Naomi. So we'll stop there for the week.
And do we know how long Naomi was away?